You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of August 2013 on Monaco 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall. Kenji, what do you have for us?
I'll be talking about contaminated dairy exports from New Zealand, a lawsuit in South Korea related to wartime grievances against Japanese companies, and Singapore's plans to redevelop its airport to tap growing demand for air travel in Southeast Asia.
Also on the program will be in Egypt, where the crisis continues.
We are going to bring Sisi down. Then we'll enjoy our democracy. We'll bring back our president.
We'll be on the line with our Cairo correspondent for the latest.
Also ahead, we'll get a sneak peek into Monocle magazine's next issue. Today, we'll get a tour of two leading diplomatic schools in Brussels and Santiago de Chile.
And we'll also be finding out why those who holiday in Tel Aviv don't need to bring books to the beach. Literature comes to them.
Hopefully, yes, that they will take and return. But if they don't return it, maybe something good is coming out of that. That he has a book and he will get into reading somehow, somewhere.
All that plus we'll say good morning to Paris. We'll read through the Turkish front pages and we'll even play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy 60 minutes coming up ahead, but before all that, here is David Spencer with the world headlines.
Thank you. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. Dozens of Muslim Brotherhood prisoners have been shot dead in Cairo as they were being transferred to jail. Authorities say one of them tried to take a police officer hostage as they tried to escape. 38 prisoners are thought to have died in the prison van. Several more are in a critical condition. At least 52 people are now known to have died when a ferry and a cargo ship collided in the central Philippines. Bad weather has hampered a search to locate close to 70 people who are still missing after a ferry sank off Cebu on Friday. 800 people were on board when the boat sank. On Monday, most parts of the capital, Manila, were at a standstill following floods due to heavy rain. The trial date for Oscar Pistorius, who's accused of murdering his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp on Valentine's Day, is expected to be confirmed today. The Olympic and Paralympic star is due to be formally served with an indictment at a short court hearing in Pretoria, which is due to start in the next half an hour. The state argues that Pistorius deliberately murdered Steenkamp, but he claims he mistook her for an intruder when he fired shots into a bathroom door. Johannesburg-based lawyer Johan Kurtzer has been following the case closely and won't be surprised if the trial is delayed.
Typically, we can expect arguably March, April next year. And in reality, that is when the trial should start. However, there's various aspects that can still take place before then and what can affect the date.
Brazil has expressed grave concern about the detention at London's Heathrow Airport of one of its citizens, the partner of a journalist who published documents leaked by Edward Snowden. David Miranda is the partner of Glenn Greenwald, who works for Britain's Guardian newspaper and was held for 9 hours at the airport and had several items seized. Brazil said the detention was unjustified, while Greenwald called it an attack on press freedom. South Korea begins a fresh set of military exercises with the United States today, a few months after a similar operation led to increased tension with North Korea. Thousands of soldiers are taking part in a computer-aided drill designed to test defense capabilities. South Korea says that the North was notified well in advance, and these exercises take place with tensions easing in the peninsula. On Sunday, North Korea agreed to a South Korean proposal to resume reuniting families separated since the 1950-1953 Korean War. The first same-sex weddings have taken place in New Zealand. The Parliament passed a bill in April making the ceremonies legal, making New Zealand the first country in the Asia-Pacific region and 14th in the world to do so. Among 31 couples to tie the knot on the first day were Australians Trent Candler and Paul McCarthy.
We're both honoured to have been able to come to a country that we respect and that respects us for who we are and respects everyone for who they are. And, you know, we're going back to Australia and, yes, technically our marriage won't be recognised. But you know what, in the back of our heads, we know that New Zealand believes in us and New Zealand is behind us all the way. So that's what's really important.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today is our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall. He joins us from our Tokyo bureau. Kenji, welcome to the program. Where should we begin today?
Let's start off with steelmakers, Nippon Steel and Sumitomo Metal Corp. This is the world's second largest steelmaker, has said that it will comply if the South Korean Supreme Court upholds a ruling ordering it to compensate for South Korean wartime slave labor in a long-running court battle. This is quite a turn of events because the Seoul High Court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in early July. And initially, the company said that it would fight the ruling all the way up to the Supreme Court, but now it seems it is almost willing to comply with the High Court decision.
And of course, this has been a 16-year legal battle, so it's a long-running saga. But of course, the two countries are key trading partners now. Do you think that's played into this resolution at all?
It's a good question. It's hard to really determine what the company is thinking because the company has only come out with this through unnamed sources in the Japanese press. As you point out, so Japan's brutal colonization of the Korean Peninsula happened from 1910 to 1945. And during that time, about 780,000 South Koreans or Koreans were conscripted into forced labor. The issue has been a major point of tension between the two companies, partly because South Korea thinks that Japan should compensate for this and also should apologize completely, whereas Japan thinks that the 1965 treaty, which essentially formalized diplomatic relations between the two sides, settled all of these types of issues.
Well, you mentioned that number there, 780,000 South Koreans conscripted into forced labor. This case dealt with just four South Korean victims for this compensation. Do you think this perhaps may set a worrying precedent?
It's a good question because there are other court cases outstanding. One that has recently occurred has been in the Busan High Court in late July. The court ordered Mitsubishi Heavy Industries to pay compensation of about 80 million Korean won to five Koreans who were forced to work for the company during this period of Japanese colonial rule. Mitsubishi Heavy has said that it will appeal the ruling to the Supreme Court and that it has no intention of reaching out-of-court settlements at this point. It could set a precedent in the future.
Moving on to Singapore, incredible images online of what's going to be, well, they say a new terminal, but it looks a bit more like a new airport, to be honest. Tell us about Project Jewel, as it's being titled.
Project Jewel, this is an interesting idea. So Singapore is redeveloping part of its main airport. This is Changi Airport. Today it announced that Capital Malls Asia and the Singaporean and the airport authority would build a new mixed-use commercial area on the site of a car park. Now, this is supposed to be a world-class lifestyle destination. At least that's what they're billing it. And it's essentially a way for Singapore to tap more into growing demand for air travel in Southeast Asia. According to last year's figures, Changi Airport handled about 51 million passengers, a third of whom were transit passengers. And so this is the group of this is the target audience really for this redevelopment.
And of course, Changi is consistently ranked as one of the best airports in the world from Skytrax. They've got lots of competition though when it comes to other airports in the world, like, you know, in Incheon in Korea. The Middle Eastern airports are developing at a rapid pace as well. How much of this is just trying to keep pace with the rapid development of these large hubs around the world?
Oh, it's entirely to keep up with all of the large hubs around the world. You know, you mentioned some of the images online. Changi Airport Group has released a few of these images, and they show beautiful gardens and waterfalls and high-tech sort of transport technology in this mall. Essentially what it's going to be is a mall. It'll be interesting to see whether this actually attracts more travelers through Changi Airport. You know, just because there's this apparent leisure attraction, will people actually select Changi as a transit point?
That's the question I just want to ask, because obviously, you know, if travelers have the option of waiting 2 or 3 hours at the airport and just staying in the terminal, or, you know, lengthening their stay over to maybe 8 or 10 hours, do you think this is really going to attract people to stay another, you know, 10 hours just to visit this new project jewel?
I doubt it. I have my doubts about this. At the same time, I think that the ratings for the airport could soar. Most of, you know, your average transit experiences in Asia are pretty poor. As you mentioned, Changi is one of the better airports in Asia, and, you know, this could actually improve its image significantly.
Moving on now to a story in China and New Zealand milk products, which have actually been banned after elevated levels of nitrates were found. Tell us a bit more about that.
That's right. So more New Zealand milk products have been that were sold to China. These are between the exporter in New Zealand and the importer in China, have been banned after elevated levels of nitrate were found. New Zealand's agriculture regulator said today that it's revoked the export certificates for 4 China-bound batches of lactoferrin. This is manufactured by a company called Westland Milk Products. 2 of the 4 batches actually were shipped to China, but hadn't reached consumers. So thankfully, at this point, it just seems to be at the business level.
And of course, this just comes weeks after there was a similar scare when it comes to the world's largest dairy manufacturer, Fonterra. How devastating is this potentially for the New Zealand dairy market?
This is very difficult for New Zealand's dairy market because New Zealand relies on dairy exports for about a quarter of its roughly $37 billion U.S. dollars in annual export earnings. If you look at China's market, Chinese consumers have been hypersensitive about dairy since contaminated baby formula sickened about 300,000 children and killed 6 in China. This is back in 2008. There have been sporadic incidents, similar incidents since. At the same time, when you look at China's market, foreign brands account for half of China's sales of infant formula, and demand for foreign milk powder is so high that often the shelves are cleared of this sort of product. Also, you see in places like Singapore and Hong Kong, Chinese tourists actually hoarding products that they can take home. And as a result, you know, the shelves in those markets also cleared.
As you said earlier, it doesn't seem to be a significant amount of the product. But what's the level of alarm then if there is this appetite domestically for the product?
The level of alarm, I think, is high. At the same time, as I mentioned, this latest incident with New Zealand was caught at a time when, you know, the authorities could do something about it. Initial investigations point to the contamination caused by cleaning products, which apparently contain nitrates, and in this case appear to have not been properly flushed from the plant before the product was made. At this point, it does appear that they know what the cause is, they know the route, they know how many batches are out there, and so the alarm level so far is low.
Okay, Kenji Hall and Tokyo, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be in Egypt to get the latest on the unfolding political crisis.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
And welcome back to the program. The time here in London is 8:17. Now, in only 5 days, over 800 people have died in Egypt. Repression has turned to massacre. Yet, in his first televised appearance since the police moved to clear Islamist sit-ins last Wednesday, the head of the armed forces, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, called for help rebuilding the democratic path.
Many doubt that a democratic transition will resume seamlessly. Still, large parts of the population in Egypt continue supporting the army. Our regular contributor Rebecca Collard spoke to pro-Morsi and pro-army supporters in the streets of Cairo. Here's what they said.
Never, I never ever scared. Even Rabah, they shot me 3 times. The bullet went and I felt the heat of the bullet, and I never scared. Nobody of these guys scared. We are going to bring Sisi down. Then we'll enjoy our democracy. We'll bring back our president.
Imen Hagag. I mean, I'm marching today because I really can't believe what happened in the past couple of days, and this isn't really about political affiliations anymore. This is, I mean, this is life and death, this is humanity. And, you know, I used to go to Rabah all the time, and now it's like burned to the ground, and I really can't believe what's happening. I'm for democracy, and I'm not necessarily pro-Morsi, but I think it's wrong at the end of the day that if you elect somebody, for you to overthrow him. I mean, you don't do that to President Obama, you give him their term. 4 years, then let it be. Because what's happening right now is chaos, it's insanity.
May Afifi. The army are the very wise when dealing with things. This is number one. I trust my army, I trust my police. If one dies, 10 dies, I die, I don't care. The most important thing is the country to go back up again on its feet. Here in Egypt, army is very, it's something very strong for us. Each of us has a soldier inside. Army for us is taboo.
The views of pro-Morsi and pro-army supporters interviewed in Cairo by Rebecca Collard. And to further discuss the situation in Egypt, we're joined on the line by Monocle's contributor in Cairo, Abdul Rahman Hussein. Abdul, thank you very much for sparing the time to talk to us. I'd like to start first. Of course, we saw yet more distressing and dramatic scenes over the weekend. What's the situation on the ground there now as you see it?
Well, it's been a bloody night. Last night, there are reports of 36 detainees, mostly soldiers who were detained, who were killed in exceptionally murky circumstances. We don't really know the reason why. There were reports that they were attempting a prison break or they were attempting to flee. And then the other reports said they died in a police van. Others said they died in a prison. What we do know is that 36 detainees were killed due to a tear gas, plus a bomb and suffocation being thrown in their midst. And then not more than a few hours ago, we had 24 special security soldiers, conscripts inside, who have been killed in an ambush by suspected militants. So the death toll is inexorably rising. It's just getting bigger and bigger as the conflict grows bigger.
And Abdel, we heard there from one of those people on the ground in Cairo that Rebecca Collard spoke to. You know, she said, "I trust my army. The army is stable. I am a soldier." Is there a growing sense there on the ground for those that have supported the army that they're increasingly getting concerned with the way that the army and the military and security forces have been behaving in the last couple of days?
Well, Egypt has been really polarized, and people who have been in very entrenched positions on both sides, emotions are running exceptionally high. And those who support the army still do support the army, but at one point, people are going to ask what is going on. There has to be concern about the rise in death toll every day. It is becoming, the situation is becoming very, very, very untenable.
And we've already seen those images of the mosques and pro-Morsi supporters being targeted there, ice cubes being brought in to cool the bodies. Are we going to see yet more offensives targeted on these small pockets?
I would assume so. I think that the semblance or the appearance of security is what matters at this point, and you see a matter of perception. And the security of this nation, the army has tied it directly to the presence of Morsi soldiers in the streets or not. And I think that in that respect, we might be seeing more of that. But on the other hand, you are having an incredible number of attacks on churches throughout the country, on some police stations and other acts like that, and security forces have been up until this point unable to counter that in any way. And then we also have the rising violence in Sinai, which is violence on another level because militants there tend to be a lot better armed. So that is proving an issue, but with the media that has been very happy to promote the army line without questioning and without judgment. So the narrative here is being skewed in favor of presenting the Morsi supporters as terrorists, and that this is a fight against terrorism, and it's a zero-sum game, and both sides are very, very entrenched in their position.
Abdelrahman Hussein there reporting from Cairo. It's on a developing situation. And later today, senior diplomats from the EU are actually going to be meeting in Brussels on Monday today to discuss how to use or at least leverage some of that 5 billion euros worth of grants and aid to Egypt. So it's a developing situation there on the ground and outside of Egypt as well. We'll continue to cover it here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Now, all this week on Midori House, we'll be taking a close look at the next issue of Monocle. Today, we start with the affairs section, where we visit diplomatic schools around the world. We asked our Santiago correspondent, Stephen Bodson, to describe Academia Diplomatica de Chile. Here's Steve.
Chile's diplomatic academy is in a palace in the historic core of Santiago. Walking in is an experience. The building has a marble staircase and a hallway that extends the length of the block. Tastefully spaced along the walls, you find little glass-topped dark wood tables full of diplomatic ribbons and medals. The school's director, Pablo Cabrera, is a distinguished-looking gentleman. His white hair is brushed back, and he looks perfectly comfortable in these antique leather chairs in his office. Photos show him with Queen Elizabeth and other notables. But the place isn't as stodgy as it looks. The school's 21 students spend their time between classes in a high-ceilinged, open-plan office full of computers, and they're assigned tablet computers each semester, preloaded with their readings. In fact, it's those forward-looking aspects of the place that occupy Cabrera's mind. He talks a lot about public diplomacy and using the academy to connect directly with the public around the world. The school maintains a website of diplomacy news and a YouTube channel full of presentations and interviews by Chilean thinkers. The school invited universities to bid on a project to overhaul the academy's curriculum, and Santiago's top universities, the Universidad de Chile and Universidad Católica, together won that contest. The curriculum now includes a course in innovation and entrepreneurship. Cabrera says the school helps Chile connect with the world through classes as well. It invites people from all around Latin America and the Caribbean each year for courses. And every year, one of the students comes from Argentina.
Steve Bodson on a very outward-looking diplomatic school there. And now we head to Bruges, where Monocle's Brussels correspondent Charlotte MacDonald Gibson talks about how diplomats there get trained up.
The College of Europe in Bruges is one of those fantastic places where you have a lot of old-fashioned values and a lot of history, meeting the modern world and combining those two ideas beautifully. The campus is like Oxford or Cambridge, with the campus buildings and the residences dotted all over this medieval town where tourists come from all over the world to marvel at old Europe. At the same time, there's some striking new architecture in buildings that have sprung up as the college expands. The College of Europe was founded as a postgraduate institute in 1948, and those post-war ideals of diplomacy bringing peace and stability are still very much fostered, but that's not to say it's not adapting to the current climate in Europe at the moment. Teachers, lecturers, and students are all very much aware of some of the animosity being directed towards the European Union as the austerity measures being put in place to combat the crisis are causing very high unemployment, especially among young people. So the lecturers are trying to give the students the tools and the knowledge they need to answer those questions, because these young people are going to be the next generation of Europe's diplomats. I would say that the young men and women I met at the College of Europe were full of optimism for the future. They were a very bright bunch of people, and most of them spoke three or four languages and already had at least one master's. And they had lots of constructive ideas about how the European Union could change and adapt to communicate their message better. They certainly didn't share some of the more negative sentiment we're seeing in some quarters of Europe at the moment about the EU being a doomed project. They very much saw the European Union as a strong force in the world and one they were very much looking forward to being part of.
Fascinating insight into the diplomatic palaces across the world that people are learning in. That was Charlotte MacDonald Gibson in Bruges, and tune in tomorrow as we delve into the business section.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll check in with our man in Paris, Tom Burgess Watson. We'll leaf through the Turkish front pages and we'll browse through the books of Tel Aviv's mobile library.
Hopefully, yes, that they will take and return. But if they don't return it, maybe something good is coming out of that, that he has a book and he will get into reading somehow, somewhere.
Intrigued. Who's he talking about? But first, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you. At least 24 Egyptian policemen have been killed in an attack in the Sinai Peninsula. The police were travelling in two buses which came under attack. Meanwhile, Egypt's Interior Ministry says 36 Muslim Brotherhood prisoners have died during an attempt to escape near Cairo. They were being transferred to jail at the time, and authorities claim they were suffocated by tear gas. At least 52 people are now known to have died when a ferry and a cargo ship collided in the central Philippines. But heavy rain has hampered the search for 70 people still missing after the ferry sank off Cebu on Friday. A train's killed at least 10 people crossing a track in eastern India, triggering a protest by passengers who beat the driver unconscious, attacked other staff and torched a carriage. One report put the death toll at 22, with dozens injured. The trial date for Oscar Pistorius, who's accused of murdering his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp on Valentine's Day, is expected to be confirmed today. The Olympic and Paralympic star is attending a court hearing in Pretoria. South Korea is beginning a fresh set of military exercises with the United States today, a few months after a similar operation led to increased tension with North Korea. Thousands of soldiers are taking part in computer-aided drills designed to test defence capabilities. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Thank you for joining us with me, Cordelia Lynch and Phil Hahn. Now, in this week's episode of Culture, we turn the dial in Istanbul and meet the radio station Bucking Trends. We're looking at art presented on the periphery, and we're backstage at Flow Festival in Helsinki. But in this preview, we're in Israel.
Now, a good book on the beach, for many of us, it's one of the simple pleasures of being on holiday. Are you a big fan of reading books on the beach, Cordelia?
I am, but I all have this really nasty habit of getting really dry factual books and then finding I can't work my way through it. I've got to go for more fiction.
You need like one of those Dan Brown books.
Yeah, I need simple, a smutty, easy read.
Just a bit of a dirty read.
Poor old Dan Brown, he won't be pleased with that summary, will he?
Well, what happens if you forget your reading material? Well, for those lucky enough to have time off in Tel Aviv, there's now a mobile library just steps away from the sea, and it's all free.
Oh, great bonus. Now, Marika Peters got off her towel to browse the shelves and found some good literary surprises.
I have my book, my personal book, in my bag, Metamorphoses, the book of Kafka.
That's it. Not a bit too heavy for on the beach?
No, it is funny.
It's a weekday on Tel Aviv's Metzizim beach, which is crowded with people playing games, sunbathing, drinking beer, and reading. Unlike David, who's opted for a rather existential text, which he bought from home, others are dipping into a range of lighter paperback novels which they've picked off the shelves of a new mobile library.
The Weird Case of the Dog in the Night Clock.
This girl's returning a well-worn copy of the best-selling Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which she took out this morning. She's only read a couple of chapters and is putting it back because she's got to leave. But it doesn't matter if it's not there when she comes back tomorrow because she's already read it 3 or 4 times, she tells me.
I know the end, so I think that I will take another book.
Tel Aviv's chief librarian Miriam Posner came up with the idea of a beach-based book service after hearing about similar schemes in Europe.
Tel Aviv has these gorgeous beaches, and Tel Aviv, you know, it is the central culture city of Israel. So I think new initiatives and ideas are very well accepted in Tel Aviv, and all the responses have been really great.
Not surprising, perhaps, considering there are no membership fees and the books are all free. Basically, anyone who wants to read can wander up and help themselves. It's based on a trust system, which doesn't always work, Miriam tells me. They started off with 500 titles, but are now down to just over half that, and her staff have to regularly restock with new books.
We hoped that they would, you know, age with grace, but they, most of them disappear, sadly enough. It's something to do with the culture. Israelis are not, are known for, you know, taking the towels from the hotels, the bathrooms, and so on, and now the books from the beach.
Petty thievery aside, everyone I talk to agrees it's a great idea. And so what if someone takes one and doesn't bring it back, asked David.
Hopefully, yes, that they will take and return. But if they don't return it, maybe something good is coming out of that, that he has a book and he will get into reading somehow, somewhere.
Miriam hopes that by providing books in different languages, they'll attract the wide range of Tel Aviv's residents from all backgrounds.
What we have here is in Russian, first of all, of course, in Hebrew, but also in Russian and English. We put some books in French also, and also in Arabic. Not because we anticipate many Arab users here on this specific beach, but, you know, to show that we don't ignore the fact that people also speak Arabic in this country. It is to make, you know, the presence of the book more more visible in the public sphere, and to encourage people to read everywhere they are.
She knows the scheme won't turn Tel Avivians into avid readers overnight, and nor does she expect an increase in the number of visitors to normal libraries. But Miriam says if she sees just a few beach bookworms getting into a good read, she'll be happy. And with that, she leaves me to lie down and enjoy some literature. For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Mareike Peters.
I reckon she's on to something, don't you?
Yeah, I just love the sounds of the waves there in the background. It just makes me want to be somewhere like that. Not that Studio One here at Midori House is anything.
Oh,
bad.
It's lovely. You know, we'll
nice
imagine the sunshine and shores.
Even though we are wearing scarves and we're mugged up.
The Baltic interior of Midori House. You are listening to Midori House, and we'll be right back after this. The latest news out of Paris.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? Different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Nockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Falooda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Crew.
Come with us from
Georgia
before we zip to
Istanbul
on Route 4 as we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in, that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
The time is 8:39 here in London. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world.
And joining us now on the line from Paris is Monocle's correspondent there, Tom Burgess-Watson. Tom, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Very well indeed. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning. Let's begin with some good news out of France when it comes to the economy.
Absolutely, and very unexpectedly good news as well, because no one saw this coming. There were surveys of analysts all over the place the last couple of weeks, people forecasting what the economic picture was going to look like at the end of the second quarter. And when the results came out, lots of champagne corks, I expect, were flying, because France, the economy grew 0.5%. That was announced last week for the April to June quarter. And that means that France is officially out of a recession. It's been registered two negative quarters, so not a very long recession, but France has been in and out of recession for the last 3 or 4 years. So it's good news for Mr. Hollande, because a lot of people have been really quite worried about where he was taking the French economy. It's the best quarter yet in President Hollande's 15 months in office. And I think it's a good sign. Mr. Hollande had been saying for a long time the recovery had begun, but no one really believed him, because unemployment is still very high. But it's good news not just for France, but for the whole Eurozone, because together with Germany, France has helped to lift the whole Eurozone out of its 1.5-year-long recession, because those figures out of France and Germany economies number one and two in the bloc. Means the whole bloc is now just very fractionally out of a recession. So lots of people saying that, together with better growth out of the United States as well, which clocked about 0.4% growth in that second quarter, slightly better, in fact, than the United States, everyone's starting to say perhaps this global recovery is now underway and it's for real.
And a huge sigh of relief, I can imagine, from Hollande. But how much can he be, and is he, being credited with this?
Well, his finance minister, Pierre Moscovici, was very quick to say this is no accident. It is not an accident at all that our country is out of the economy. It's all the result of a great master plan. Not all that many people are buying that, because one of the main factors behind the growth, 0.5% growth, so it's respectable, but not astronomical, is consumer spending. And the consumer spending, when you look at the figures and you drill them down a little bit more, actually, a lot of it, unfortunately, relates to higher heating bills that we've all had to pay here in France, because we had a pretty rough second quarter in terms of weather. So if you look at the figures, and you really analyze them, I think that heating bill is perhaps a little bit of a depressing reason for the consumer spending to have lifted the economy out of the recession that was in. But exports are up, so that's a good thing. And, you know, I think perhaps Mr. Hollande can rub his hands to a certain extent and say that not dragging France down the austerity road, which Mr. Sarkozy had threatened to do, and which other European leaders have done with fairly dire consequences, perhaps Mr. Hollande can say that this is all part of a master plan and it's paid dividends.
Tom, let's move on to another story which is really dominating the coverage there in France, and it's over the death of an 88-year-old lawyer known as the Devil's Advocate. Fill us in on this story.
This man was really quite remarkable. His name is Jacques Vergès, and he had defended what really reads like an A to Z of the world's monsters. He defended, as a lawyer, former Nazis, terrorists, notorious dictators. He was a man with a truly remarkable life as well. His life story, I can just see it being turned into a film very, very shortly. This man who was born in Reunion Island, he's of mixed Vietnamese and French parentage, began sort of making a name for himself as a sort of vehement anti-colonialist. He converted to Islam. He took up Algerian nationality. Lots of things that perhaps in the day turned a few heads. And when he started defending people like Klaus Barbie, who'd been the head of the Gestapo in Lyon, and who'd been convicted for, who was eventually convicted for crimes against humanity, people were very surprised he took on his defense, because this was a man who was indefensible. He then took on the case of Carlos the Jackal, who was the Venezuelan terrorist. He also defended Slobodan Milosevic, Tariq Aziz, who was one of Saddam Hussein's right-hand men. Lots of very improbable clients, and his goal was to defend everyone. He even said he'd defend Hitler if he had to, because that, he said, was his job. But he was a mysterious man. He did all sorts of funny things in his life, like vanish for a period of 8 or 9 years at one point without saying a word to any of his family members. And even now, no one knows where he was during those 8 or 9 years. And he really played on all the mystery that surrounded him. So he was an extraordinary man. His life ended in an extraordinary way. He died last week in the same bedroom that Voltaire, the philosopher of the Enlightenment, died in. So a very fitting end to a very extraordinary life.
Well, you mentioned Voltaire. There did seem to be a bit of sort of self-mythologizing about this man as well. Do you think he sort of reveled in the self-promotion of backing unpopular, contentious figures?
Oh, I certainly think so. I think he revels in all the mystery that surrounded him, and as I said before, I'd be extremely surprised if there isn't a film made about him, because when I was reading his obituaries, and there were lots of them, because this, as Phil was saying, was a front page story in France, I just couldn't help thinking that here is the great text for a film. And you know what an improbable set of clients to put your hand up and say, I want to defend these people. I mean, you really couldn't have defended more difficult people to defend, and yet he made his name for himself in that very way. He sort of gave two fingers to the establishment, really from a very early age, and that carried on right till the end of his life. An extraordinary man.
Tom, I think you, Cordelia, and I should start on a screenplay for this film. I think we've got a good idea here. Tom, there's another story which you've highlighted for us. And while many French people are enjoying the August holidays, some bad news, though, for some bakers.
Yeah, well, bad news for me, because I'm in Paris in August, and there doesn't seem to be anyone else here. But the whole city is shut down for the month of August, as a lot of other European capitals are, too. And the question is, how do you buy bread in August? Because, shock horror, you can't get your hands on a loaf of bread or a croissant in the morning. You don't really feel like you're in France anymore.
Devastating.
But Paris, thankfully, has 1,200 bakeries. And there's a law that dates back to the French Revolution, which says they can't all shut at the same time and go on holiday. So there's a rota for the French bakeries. Like all French workers, people who work in bakeries are allowed their 5 weeks off a year of a public holiday, but you basically get divided into one of two groups as a baker. You rotate each year, and 1 year you're allowed to go on holiday in July, the next year you can go in August, and then you swap back again. And it's a very sensible system, because it means everyone who's stuck in Paris, like me, can get their croissant and their baguette in the morning, and the bakers are happy, because there's not an awful lot of business anyway, so there's not much point in them all staying open if there's hardly any business. So it's a sensible system, but it dates back an awfully long way. And I was reading it goes back to the 18th century. So I can console myself for not being on the beach with a nice loaf of bread.
And of course, readily available is a fine accompaniment of wine and champagne there at the moment. A great harvest this year for France.
It's looking that way. The agriculture minister has given its forecast. They say that champagne production is going to be up 56% this year.
Wow.
And wine production up 11% versus last year. The producers aren't celebrating just yet, because the harvest isn't until September, so we've got another few weeks to go, and all they need is a really bad weather spell for all of that to be ruined, but none forecast for the time being. It has been a fairly odd year for weather, but last year was even worse for the Bordeaux region. But for the Champagne region, it's looking extremely good.
So who needs bread and cheese when you've got wine and champagne? That's all you need, isn't it, to make life happy?
Tom, you have all the luxuries to indulge in you could possibly want.
Indeed. But it's not that great news for you and I who like consuming the stuff. Unfortunately, champagne, I didn't even notice, is made from the grapes of several years' harvests. So all this does, this surplus of grapes, is help make up the shortfall from previous, more disappointing harvests. So we won't see the prices plummet, and we won't see extra bottles on the shelf, but at least it means we won't see fewer bottles and higher prices, because what we've seen is with this increase in the number of grapes and a better harvest, we see the champagne vintage for the last couple of years, we've averaged out and improved what had been a shortfall in good quality grapes.
Well, Tom Burgess Watson in Paris, thank you very much for navigating us through the culinary delights of
I'm
Paris.
I'm thirsty.
Me too.
Well, in just a moment, we'll be looking at this morning's Turkish front pages with Monocle's Alexandra de Kramer. Not sure if she'll have any wine or champagne for us. But before all that, we're going to hear some Turkish music. This is Hande Yener with her hit, Ya Ya Ya.
Yeah, it's so definite.
I think I gave too many yas then. No, you've had enough.
Well, at least she's emphatic. That was Turkish pop star Hande Yener with her hit Ya Ya Ya. You're listening to Midori House with me, Cordelia Lynch and Phil Hahn. And said woman, Alexandra de Kramer, is here now in the studio to talk us through the stories we need to know in today's Turkish newspapers. Alex, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello.
Are you a fan of Ya 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 there?
I'm a fan of Hande Yener. She's really good. It's like the Turkish Lady Gaga. Okay, you're looking
She's the Turkish Lady Gaga.
Yes.
Really?
Wow. Like the way she dresses and dances. And
so that song would have been the number one hit?
Yeah. No, I don't know really, but hopefully.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. We found a supporter.
Her, you know?
Okay. Let's move on. Alex, you brought in a couple of the Turkish front pages this morning. Let's begin with Cumhuriyet newspaper, shall we?
Yes, sure. So Cumhuriyet's headline for today is Gezi-related, of course. So there, the education ministry, the Ministry of Education, is doing another operation in Ankara, which is the headline, which the headline reads, another secret witness operation. They've called in 6, 7, and 8 graders in and given them blank papers. By the way, it's summer holidays. So they've commissioned them to come back to school during summer holidays to write down whether their fellow students have been protesting in Gezi Park or whether they have gathered this information, because you know everything happens through social media networks like Facebook and stuff. So basically they want, because they can't track it down, who connected with who sent who a message, because it's anonymous on the internet. They're trying to get kind of links of people, like students, like who told you go to Gezi Park, who told you about Gezi Park, and they're trying to pinpoint people now. Which is...
That just seems absolutely
outrageous.
Incredible.
Absurd, sort of Orwellian, to be honest. And it's going to be surely impossible. I mean, I remember on the days at the apex of some of the action, you know, these are multiple profiles from thousands of students. The idea that they're going to be able to track down and hunt those responsible, it was too big a movement to pin it down, surely.
That's what I think. I think what they basically want to do, they're saying, we'll keep you anonymous if you tell us which friend told you about Gezi Park and who shared what with you and who put this video viral. We won't tell you, but we'll get these people. Because that's what happened via... They had also an operation through Twitter. So they actually tracked down... They believe that photographs are evidence. And some people had retweeted pictures of like a fire that was happening, and they like pinned it on like you started this fire. So kind of these little things. So
but
I feel
they,
like
do they actually expect these students to actually, you know, turn confess. These people and confess?
You're 12 years old. The government asks you write your friend's name down on a piece of paper. What are you going to do? I think I wouldn't be able to think for myself. They're like 12, 14. How old are you when you're in 6th, 7th, 8th grade? You know, it's like.
But were they, I mean, is there a perception that they were the architects of some of those some of that direct action, because certainly, you know, the television pictures, there were people in their early 20s, mid-20s and older that were kind of at the forefront of it.
Exactly. It wasn't really middle schools. It was more university students and above. I just think it is interesting. There was also like the police actually did a video against Gezi Park. It starts off like with a kid protesting, and then she's in the middle of a bazaar and she's shaking because she's strapped on with a bomb and she's going to explode herself, and she's like, let's take care of our kids. The friendly protest can turn into something really dangerous, and it's actually streaming on the TV. This is like, wow. Because and then it says the Turkish police is here to protect you. They did it with our tax money, which I think is really, really hilarious.
Well, from that story, let's move on to the Hurriyet newspaper. Obviously, we know Turkey has been trying for some time now to gain membership into the European Union, and that struggle continues.
Yeah, so there's a picture in Hurriyet today of Egemen Bağış, who's our EU affairs and chief negotiator. And next to him is Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, who's a member in parliament. He's a representative from Antalya. So they're basically opening an EU office in Brussels because recently, of course, they've come under a lot of criticism and stress due to Gezi protests. And they want to show as AK Party that they still are Western and they still want to become part of the West. So I think it's a really interesting move coming. And recently, like they're basically trying to change the headlines to move things forward. We haven't heard anything that's happening in terms of the EU negotiations. On the contrary, when Gezi Park happened, Germany had said that they don't want Turkey. They're not going to grant Turkey and sit down with them in regards to their EU membership. I think it's really it's an important move for Turkey, and I think it's interesting that the choice is Brussels and. That's happening newly.
And very quickly, Alex, Turkish cargo sector is growing.
Oh, So really quickly. So Turkish cargo sector has grown 10% over the last 7 months, which is a really huge deal. Because we're bordering Syria and Egypt on the eastern side, and due to the turmoil, obviously.
And of course, Istanbul is becoming such an international hub for air traffic as well. Not just cargo, but also passenger flights as well. Alex de Kramer there with the Turkish Front Pages. Many thanks for coming onto the program. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our lovely producer, Daphne Denny. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Falco. And our studio manager was the very talented and capable Alex Funnel. Well, up next after the news is The Urbanist. I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds from Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Cordelia Lynch. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.